Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, listeners, Kevin and I need your help.
Yes, we need your help. Please, please, please. We need your stars. We need your reviews, you guys, on iTunes so we can start to climb those iTunes rating charts.
It's simple. Open iTunes, click on the iTunes store, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Then click on ratings and reviews. Under the customer reviews, click write a review. Then let us know what you think from 1 to 5 stars.
If you need some help, think of 1 star being Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the Road Company of the last 5 years, and 5 stars being free front row tickets to Hamilton. Although, when you think about it, I actually would give 5 stars to the Road Company of Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the last 5 years, because I think that would be awesome.
I would love to hear, can I hear Moving Too Fast as Paul? that's the one I really want.
She's a chick's the goddess. Been through Erica Schwartz and Danica Weiss and the Handelman twins.
So there you go. You can also leave a comment if you like.
That's it. That's
your reviews.
It.
Send us your reviews, please. Friends.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain and on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. We're also very excited to announce that you can listen to us on Broadway Radio.
Ooh, how exciting. Now, Kevin, this week's guest fascinates me so much for a couple of reasons. Mm-hmm. Here's only a couple. How many children do you know went as Susan Stroman for Halloween?
Not many, Rob.
Or Mary Flynn from Merrily We Roll Along.
And I want to know, was it like a t-shirt? Was it like...
We're going to find out in a second, because I'm fascinated to know how
and
this happened.
As if that wasn't impressive enough, our legend's resume has these credits on it. Director of Programming at Feinstein's 54 Below. Author of The Untold Stories of Broadway, which is... I was just reading it today again. It's so good. Get that book, please. Co-creator of the Bistro Award-winning If It Even Only Runs a Minute series, as well as working on countless Broadway shows and concerts in various capacities.
Still not impressed?
Mm-mm.
Our guest was recently named one of the 10 professionals on Backstage Magazine first annual Broadway Future Power List, saying that she is leading the conversation on contemporary musical theater. And, oh yeah, she did all that before turning 30.
Ooh.
Can you imagine?
No.
Ladies and gentlemen, to take us from back to before to the hills of tomorrow, here is Jennifer Ashley Tepper.
That is like the best intro I've ever gotten. Thanks, guys.
All true. All fact.
All true. This is fascinating. You are our youngest guest by far.
Wow.
But already a legend.
That's very sweet. Thank
you.
So
before we jump into all the amazing things you've done, I want to go back to where you grew up. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Boca Raton, Florida.
Boca.
You might have elderly relatives there, do you?
No, but in Naples, but still. Florida. Wow.
Florida. Actually, recently I've thought a lot about how that has really nurtured theater kids, because there's so many snowbirds that want to go see shows that theater flourishes there in a weird way.
It does. Lots of theaters in Florida.
It was a delightful place to grow up.
What was your first show that you ever saw in Florida?
The first show I ever saw was, we fight about this all the time, like my parents and I can't decide if it was a touring cast of Fiddler or Chorus Line. We saw both like within a couple weeks of each other. So maybe it was like both.
Nice.
Either. Both.
Those are two really good ones though.
They were both very formative and I loved them both.
So the family was supportive about you and your theatrical endeavors.
My family is basically all in medicine in one way or another. Like, my dad's a doctor, my mom's an occupational therapist, but everyone loved theater. Like, everyone was so into it. I never had anyone in my family who was in it, but they loved seeing it and loved that I was interested in it and were very supportive.
Were you interested, like, right at a young age, like, obsessed, like...
Yes. It was going to see tours, and it was also going to theater camp, like literally day camp in Florida, and doing like Annie and Bye Bye Birdie, and then going, I want to learn about all the shows. And so it was a lot of like begging my parents for cast recordings and books and watching the Tonys. It was all the stuff that we all did from afar as kids who were trying to learn about it. And that's how I grew up.
Who were you and Annie?
When I, this is the first show I was ever in, I played Drake the butler. I had a gray wig. I said, yes, sir. That was my major line. But actually, it was really funny. I went to this theater camp for like 10 years, and we would do like a different show every summer. But every 4 years, we would do Annie, like clockwork. So Annie was always the recurring show. So I was Drake when I made my like theatrical debut. And then when I was 13, I was Miss Hannigan, which was like so fun.
Step up.
And then 4 years later, I was a counselor, and I was like extra hobo and like giant orphan that helps the kids. So that was kind of the progression.
Not bad.
I'm so impressed. And then you did Bye Bye Birdie.
Yes, where I was Ursula, which is like my most typecast role ever because she just screams and is very excited about everything.
You haven't lost that.
You Thank
haven't
you.
Lost that. And that's a good thing.
I think Ursula is my spirit animal.
Hashtag Ursula, my spirit animal.
Ursula Merkel.
I love it. Were you a big movie person growing up? Did you?
Do you know, I was obsessed with a lot of, like, I was obsessed with Bette Midler Gypsy. That was, like, one of my favorite.
Me too. Yes,
really?
Totally.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Yeah.
Such a good movie, right? And that's Neil Marin and Craig Zaden, who have taken over, you know, musicals on screen.
Yeah. And she, I guess she did a lot of vocal training. She said after that movie, she's never sung better in her life because she trained so hard vocally that she was, like, in better shape than she had ever been as a singer.
That's
you can see
amazing.
It.
I didn't read that interview. That's so fascinating to me.
She's cool. Fantastic.
That cast is genius.
Yeah.
That
Elizabeth Moss is Baby Louise.
That's
Baby
right.
Louise.
So many cameos in there.
Yeah.
So many good cameos.
I need
cameos.
To watch that again.
Okay, so that was the movie musical, right?
Yes.
And then how are you getting exposed to these musicals? Was it just simply asking, you know, your folks, I want this cast recording, and it just went from there?
Yeah. You know what's so funny about it is that people definitely like wax nostalgic about like the old record store and being able to go to the store and get stuff. And I absolutely do too. And I loved going to Borders and like looking at what was labeled incorrectly as soundtracks.
Yep.
But it was so much about the internet. Like the internet, I was at the beginning of that era where internet gave us access to like theater and information that we didn't have otherwise. And I would literally go on Amazon and be like, ooh, hey, My Name is Alice sounds interesting. Mom, can I get that one next month? So it was really like the internet gave me access to all these musicals and cast recordings and like information I didn't have and that a kid 10 years earlier might not have been able to unless they were in New York or closer to New York.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of like Amazon cast recording wish lists.
What was your favorite one?
Do you know, I have been thinking about this a lot lately. In Trousers literally like blew my brain open.
Really?
Yeah. Don't, I mean, I love that cast recording so much.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
It really, I feel like that cast recording like very much that and Merrily and like so many others, Merrily being my favorite, but In Trousers being one I just don't think about as often. It like made me realize what musicals could be and that it's not a song cycle and it's not a review, obviously, but it's a theater piece, but it's not exactly a musical. And I was just like, this is new. This is like really something that theater can be.
Now, what books were you using?
I was obsessed with Not Since Carrie, which... Not
of course.
The Bible.
Of course.
And Ted Chapin's book, Everything Was Possible, is very formative to me. But, you know, there were a lot. I'd kind of just devoured anything that was about theater.
Were you a big library person? Were you always at the library?
Totally. I think, like, and this is, I think the best thing my mom ever did was she was kind of like, I love my mother. My mother has done a lot of good things. But she literally would always say to me, like, reading anything is going to be beneficial to you. It doesn't matter what it is. And for some reason, that made me feel less guilty when I was like, well, I'm going to read Sweet Valley High. But it made me a better reader because I didn't feel like it was an assignment.
Right.
I didn't feel, like, I just never got it into my head that, like, reading was a chore. I don't know. She just kind of like trained me to be a super reader. So I would read anything I could get my hands on at the library.
That's amazing. That is
so amazing,
incredible.
Actually. Yeah.
And you haven't lost that.
Yeah, I like reading. I'm reading this book right now that, oh my God, I haven't talked to anyone about this, but it's called Fanfare. And it's this book that's a press agent from like the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. Richard Maney wrote this like tell-all. I love when I can find like out-of-print books that people kind of don't remember, but that tell a lot of like relevant theater stories.
Right, it's true.
Lives.
Like, yeah.
It's really interesting. It's a good book.
Fanfare.
Yeah.
Would you get it on Amazon?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I just kind of like browse and like, oh, there's like an out-of-print theater book. Done. Sold.
Yeah. Thank you.
They're not often. I mean, they're not like expensive. You can kind of find them.
That's something like a
I never
penny.
Even thought to do that. Yep. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And then you're in high school. It's time for college.
Yeah.
And what's on your list?
Do you know I only applied to NYU?
Because you're like, that. I got to get to New York City.
Yep.
You knew that you had to be where.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, if I don't get in, I'm going to chain myself to my bedpost and reapply every semester until I get in. You can't stop me. I'm not applying anywhere else. Thank God I got in, although, I mean, it would have been fine. I would have just listened to cast recordings all the time, changed my bedpost if I hadn't. But yeah, I applied early decision. It was like, you know, I was really wanted to be in New York.
And was there ever, did you ever think about going as an actor? Was that ever an option on the table?
You know, I loved like performing growing up, but I think like I knew at a pretty young age, like I didn't want to do it as a profession. But I always thought it was so fun to be like part of the party and to be like in the ensemble of shows in high school. And like, I didn't not want to do that, but I knew it wasn't like a profession I was going to do. Mm-hmm.
Well, how did you, what major, what was your major at NYU eventually?
I actually majored in dramatic writing.
Excellent.
Which was kind of weird because I did it because I liked theater and I liked writing, but most people in that department wanted to be a playwright or a screenwriter. And I was like, I want to be a theater historian and like work in producing and do all these things. But there's no major called like theater historian, producer, director of programming.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I just kind of shaped my major a little bit. And I feel like I learned as much from being in New York as I did from being at NYU.
Oh my gosh.
Did you have a lot of mentors when you first got to New York City? Or,
you know, I mean, throughout college, I started finding those right mentors. People who I think I would consider like historians almost did a lot to kind of mentor me at school, for sure.
Did you seek out a lot of the people that you have such great relationships with now, or did they seek you out?
Oh, my God, no, definitely I seeked, suck. I sought.
Sought.
Thank you
I
so much.
After, yeah.
I actually got a pretty good SAT score. I'm pretty ashamed of that. That's what just happened, since we're talking about high school and stuff. Yeah, I sought out a lot of people. I was thinking about this recently because I recently put together this big Ed Kleban evening at 54, which was very much like a labor of love. And Ed Kleban, I always call my favorite writer that I never got to meet.
And we should say that Ed Kleban, sometimes our listeners are like, who? But he wrote A Chorus Line, among many other things. But maybe, and he was the center of the musical A Class Act.
Yeah.
But he, some people say he didn't get the recognition he was due, you might say, because he was a composer as
totally.
Well as a lyricist.
I'm really glad you made that note. So yeah, Ed Kleban, obviously, you know, he wrote a lot of musicals. The only one that anyone really actually knows is Chorus Line, although, of course, Class Act told the story of his life. But this project was, I've always, like, I loved A Class Act. It just really affected me. Mm-hmm. I love that you did, too. And Ed Kleban, his longtime woman in his life, Linda Klein, who wrote the book to A Class Act, I interviewed her for something about a year and a half ago and went, all I want is to uncover a bunch of this Ed Kleban material that nobody's heard from all of these musicals that weren't produced but have such amazing songs of his. So we really did that, and it was just the most unique experience. I always call him my favorite writer I never got to meet, because sadly, and it's amazing to think about, like, I grew up loving Craig Cornelia, and I've gotten to know Craig, and like, I grew up loving Bill Finn, and I've gotten to know Bill. Like, it's incredible, and Ed is definitely just like, if I had a time machine, I would go have dinner with him. But I do think a lot about, like, I reached out, this is a really long-winded answer to your question, but Marvin Hamlisch, I was doing like, I put together a kind of a showcase type thing for BCFA at NYU, because I was like, this will be a fun way to kind of do a review and exercise
while in college.
Those.
You were in college, just to clarify.
In college, exercise those musical theater muscles. I directed it. Jay Armstrong Johnson choreographed it. We went to school together. And a ton of great people were in it. And it was, there was some Class Act material, there was some Chorus Line material. And I was like, I'm just going to write Marvin Hamlisch a letter. I wrote him a letter. I told him like how much it meant to us that we were getting to do this material, how much we loved it. And I invited him to come see the show. And he couldn't come to the show, but he was like, I can come in the afternoon of the show and meet with you guys for like an hour and talk about it. It was amazing. It was so generous, and it was unbelievably generous. He's obviously like a very busy, very successful man, and he took this afternoon out of his life and he came to our like you know, like multi-purpose room that we were doing the show in. And he sat with us and he told us like really great stories about Chorus Line and other like, you know, things that we were talking about. And we all used to quote him because he said that he was dating when Chorus Line first came out. He wasn't married yet. And he would take women to the show and they'd be like, I love this. And he'd be like, I wrote this, baby. And so like, like,
a chorus line got him laid.
That was definitely the subtext. But like, he just, in that, he just knew how to kind of like tell funny stories like that. Yeah. College students, he was so wonderful. And we talked about Ed Kleban, of course. And it was just so memorable. And like, I was just thinking about that a lot because of the Ed Kleban evening, that like, I got to have that moment with Marvin, who sadly left us
way too soon.
Yeah. That's the kind of stuff. Like, I would write a lot of letters that led crazy places because people were unbelievably generous with their time.
A lot of students feel that if they are to write a letter or to seek out somebody that they admire and respect, that it's sort of bothering them, that it's pestering them. Mm-hmm. And for that seems to be the total opposite. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I always tell people that. It's like, nothing is less obtrusive. Like, it's a letter is so lovely. Like, you guys, I'm going to be honest. I wrote a fan letter to George C. Wolfe recently because I'm so obsessed with Shuffle Along. Like, I wrote this a week ago. And I interviewed him for my book. I mean, he doesn't know me well. We don't know each other well, but like, he knows who I am. I like wrote him this long fan letter just being like, thank you. And these are all the reasons why your show has really like affected me as a historian and made me like think a lot about things I wasn't thinking about. And I think it's always lovely to, I mean, it's not lovely to run up to someone on the street and grab them by the collar and start yelling at them about how much you love Newsies, but like, it is fine. It's fine to write a letter. It's actually lovely, and invite them to something you're doing, or, you know, that's fine.
And who doesn't want to have, you know, praise in some way? We're all human, and everybody, no matter how you're successful you are, you want to, I mean, you know, Sondheim loves to hear that people appreciate his work still, you know?
And Sondheim's so generous about writing back. Like, he really is. And a lot of people are. And even if they're not, it's like, as long as you don't expect anything back, you're just writing and saying, like, thank you. And also, you know, the letters I wrote were like, this is why your work has really affected me. And if you ever need an assistant or a PA, like, I would love to learn from you, which, you know, was very genuine. And I think people sense authenticity from letters that they get. Yeah. And if people say no, they say no. I'm sure, you know, I got plenty of people I've written to in my lifetime for an interview, for anything, like, don't write back. But that's fine. They're busy, and some people will write back. So you just have to do it. So
tell us about some of those interning and PA jobs that you had when you first came to the city.
You know, it's so funny. I really was like, I want to learn as much as I can from doing as many different things as I can. So especially in college and like the first 2 years out of school, I interned or PA'd like just insane, weird, like a week of the Addams Family workshop and like a week of like a new play James Lapine was working on and like a week of I assistant directed like an Actors Fund benefit that was at the O'Neill that I like sometimes because these things are only a week, you're just forget about them until you're at a place where you remember. Mm-hmm. Just like a lot of interesting opportunities that I was lucky enough to get to observe people, to just kind of run around and take notes or get coffee or just like, you know, take scripts.
Right, and be in the room where it happens.
You can say it. It's now part of our lexicon.
It already feels dated now. But it's true, to be a witness of all of those different events, I think, is the best educational opportunity you can get.
It was. And really, like, I mean, my first big opportunity was that I got to be Michael Barres's assistant when he was the director of Title of Show. And I knew I didn't want to be a director, but I learned so much from being a director's assistant that I felt like was relevant to things I would want to do later. That I actually, like, and then I ended up assisting Michael Greif for a while. And it was kind of like, oh, like, you know, people are confused by that. It's like, you graduated college and what you're doing this? Oh, you want to be a director? I was like, no. And I think I try to tell people that who've just graduated, like, learn a lot of things because you don't have to, there's nothing saying that the thing you do immediately after you graduate is where you have to be in 10 years. Like, just learn. Just, like, keep trying different things.
Yeah. Then, so you're doing all of these things, and I just have to ask you, where did the love from Merrily come along? I originally thought we should do today's episode backwards, that we started with goodbye and the thanks, and then we just worked our ways to hello.
And I like the original Merrily. I'm a huge. We did the original in college, like that original version. I don't know my, but it's I'm a huge fan of Merrily as well. How did that start for you?
Because I discovered things through cast recordings, everything was equal to me. It was like everything had a recording and it didn't matter if something had run 10 performances or a million, like it was all the recordings. So the Merrily recording just really immediately affected me, the original cast recording. And I went, oh my God, like I'm, you know, however old, 10 years old, but for some reason, this story of like these friends and trying to pursue the arts and like what that means in New York, like it just fully like flummoxed me. It really made me, I mean, it's really weird. I've discovered this recently. It's like, I loved Merrily and Class Act and all these musicals about musical theater writers and like young people in the city and all this stuff. And then like I did it after. I feel like people might identify with musicals that are about their life, but I kind of made my life into those musicals in a weird way. Yeah. It's so funny. Do you ever think about stuff like that?
Oh, yeah.
But so for some reason, Merrily really, just all the characters, all of what it was, and then the fact that I started learning about how it was this very ambitious, you know, not failure, but like it, the way it went on Broadway, basically.
Yeah.
I just became more and more fascinated by it. And of course, Not Since Carrie has a lot of information about Merrily that made me more fascinated as well.
Now, I know there's what, like 3 or 4 different versions of Merrily? Is that correct?
Oh, there's a lot. There's so many. I can't believe you did the original.
Because the York did it, and then they
and
London.
York and the London version, the Encores version. Now there's going to be a new version in LA. People, you know, there's all of this trying to fix it. And really, the issue is that you can't fully fix it. Like,
can you give a little rundown of the plot just for our
listeners? Sure.
In case someone is like, Merrily, I don't know that. I love
Merrily Roll Along is a musical by Stephen Sondheim and George Firth that was originally directed by Hal Prince. That's about basically 3 friends, and they're going backward. The story goes backwards in time. So it's, you know, Frank, Charlie, and Mary, who all start out at the beginning of time as very close friends, and then you see how their friendship progresses and how their life and how their careers progress. But at the beginning, when you meet them, they're at the oldest point. So it's a very, there's no way to like quote unquote fix the fact that when you meet people, they're technically more unlikable than they will be at the end. Like that's part of what the show is. You're never going to fix that. Just like on Last 5 Years, just like on anything with the time continuum, there's certain aspects of it that I think people think are going to get fixed that are, it's not a fix. Fix is not the right word.
And it ran for only like a couple, like a
it was like a
week. I don't even remember
exactly. It ran for about 2 weeks, but it was, you know, it ended Hal Prince and Stephen Sondheim's Broadway collaboration.
And this is after like, you know, Sweeney Todd. I mean, everyone was like, this is the next big show. It's going to be a hit. And it was a, and I think that's part of the reason why everyone kind of tries to fix it, even though
it's like a fascinating musical for a lot of people for that reason.
When did If It Even Only Runs a Minute come into all of this?
I started doing the concert series in January of 2010, and it was because Kevin Michael Murphy, and I love that like Kevin's with 3 names, like A+, because you know, I was thinking about that. It's a good thing to be as a Kevin with 3 names. Kevin Michael Murphy and I thought, you know, we really want to do something to celebrate underappreciated musicals. And so we started doing this concert series that brings people who originated roles and the original writers back to do songs that they sang on Broadway and off Broadway. And people who would be playing the roles if the shows came out today to sing them. And it kind of became this larger than life thing where we would have photos and, you know, behind the scenes and all of these stories. And we would narrate each of the concerts. And we've done over 15 of them now.
Wow.
And each concert has been different musicals. So we've been able to kind of bring back little pieces of all these shows that people might not remember and have people celebrate them and remember them. It's been very formative. But we're big fans of putting as much as possible on YouTube so that, like, that person can learn about it in Ohio or wherever they
are.
That
is so special. It's educational on top of being entertaining. And I think it's so important to remind young people or older people but what these shows are and who they are.
Totally. And what's cool is that I feel like little pieces of what that was have kind of trickled into, because I was doing that long before I started my job, but like, you know, 54 Below, we're doing a production, like a musical and concert of Onward Victoria this month. And it's like things like that. You know, we have an amazing group putting it together. Like, seeds have been planted from that concert series that I feel like I've been able to do. Like, we did Smile in concert. Like, it's like all these full musicals in concert or just like songwriting teams. Like, we've been able to just bring a lot of stuff back and make people, you know, understand that that's as much of a part of it as the hits are, which is really important.
And then going back, who is Kevin? And how did you get a relationship with him?
Kevin and I always just would nerd out over, like, underappreciated musicals together. We went to NYU at the same time, and we kind of became close afterwards. It's very, NYU is a very big place. Most of my good friends went to NYU. We might have been there at the same time, but we didn't become friends till after when we were, like, working on stuff, which is weird. But Kevin, I always, you know, we would just talk about, like, glory days for 5 minutes and then go away. And so we met, and we were like, let's do this concert series. And he was on the Book of Mormon tour for, like, 2 years. So we would do it more intermittently, and we hope to do it forever.
What was the first concert you did in that series?
So each concert celebrates about 15 different shows. So, yeah, so that's what we've done about, you know, like over 200 musicals now, like, because each concert will just have, the first one was literally Craig Carnelia came and talked about his life after high school, like Heidi Blickenstaff sang from Flora the Red Menace, and we told some stories about that. Nick Blamer came and did Glory Days. The first one, Nancy Anderson did Class Act. It was like all people that I kind of knew that I could get. And then the second concert was like Evan Pappas did My Favorite Year, and that's when we met. And so as the concerts grew, like by the time it's like the 14th concert, it's like a whole slate of people that I reached out to cold because they kind of know what the concert series is then.
Yep.
So yeah, we've gotten a chance to do a lot of stuff. And also we've uncovered things like Truckload, which is this musical that closed in previews in the 70s that I always was fascinated by. And we had Louis St. Louis, who's the writer, and Pat Birch.
He did Grease 2. The composer of Grease 2.
They all did Grease 2.
Yeah.
Pat Birch, who's the director. Grease 2 and Truckload are actually weirdly intertwined, which, you know.
Oh.
And the assistant director, James Dibas, who also is like original cast member of Pacific Overtures, and Do I Hear Waltz. Like, we had all these original Truckload people all come. And Eileen Graff, who was in it, she was amazing and was also there in Sing For My Love, My Wife. It was like this Truckload celebration, and it was like, as it was part of Nymph that year, we did If It Only Runs a Minute as part of Nymph, and it was literally like these 150 people walked out of the theater being like, this is the most famous musical that's ever existed, because we had like talks and songs and stories and photos, and it was like something that closed in previews where all the actors and writer and everyone found out that it was done after a show. Like, they never got to even do a final show. It closed in previews. So like, it was like this coming back to life of this thing that they had all cared so much about. And so we've been lucky enough to do a few things like that where it's like bringing something really back to life that means something to the audience and to the people on stage. I think all the other musicals we celebrated in that edition were like, oh, like, but we're not as good as Truckload.
And what a celebration for those writers is, I mean, it's good for them to be, they wouldn't have that revisited if it weren't for you. I mean, that's a really special gift to give them as well.
Okay. Well, the best thing is that when those writers are kind of like, you know, no one's asked me about this show.
And yeah.
It's something that was on Broadway. Like, you know, people believed in it. People enjoyed it. If we think about the shows that we love and enjoyed that didn't play for very long, like there's people from another time who like Truckload was their insert name of something like, you know, something that closed recently.
The Untold Story of Broadway. This is fascinating. Would you, everybody I speak to, I'm always like, you have to buy this book.
I did that when you told me to.
Oh yeah. And so I can't wait. I know there's a third one coming out soon. I'm
thank
very
you
excited
for
about that.
That.
But tell me about, what is The Untold Stories of Broadway? So what is it?
So it's a book series published by Dress Circle. Each book takes 8 different Broadway theaters and takes you through the stories of each Broadway theater chronologically through people's personal stories who I've interviewed, through discoveries that I've made that are about the theater, through basically, you know, stories from actors, directors, producers, but also stagehands and musicians and box office treasurers and people you don't hear from as often. And so what's been really cool is like each book has 8 theaters, one being a lost theater, so a theater that's no longer a Broadway house or demolished. And so that's been an interesting aspect of it. And this next book, which is my third book, which is coming out in November, what's really cool is that, you know, I started doing these interviews in 2013. I've done almost 300 interviews at this point. But I did interviews in 2013 where I went, okay, but like some of this material I'm talking to these people about is about theaters that are not even going to be in it until the third book. So there's just stuff I've been sitting on for like 3 years. And then there's also a lot of new stuff from interviews I've done in the past year.
Has anyone you've interviewed since passed?
Yeah, actually. Randy Morrison, who was a stagehand at the Schubert, who he sadly passed away. And like, I have some amazing stories from him. I've actually been trying to find his family to send them like the full audio of my interview with him.
That would be great. Yeah.
But what's really, I mean, it's amazing. And I've thought about that a lot. Actually, the third book, one of my big focuses was to interview people that are over the age of 80. Because, you know, it's maybe a little morbid, but when stories are gone, like when people are gone, the stories go with them. And I really, what's interesting to me has become, it's become more apparent as I've been working on the books, is that most of our Broadway theaters opened in the 1900s or like the 1910s. And there's no way to talk to anyone, obviously, who was in them for the first 30 years. Like, all those people are gone. And I will do a lot of research to try to read books that were written 50 years ago or articles to give the story of the first 30 years in the theater. And then there's like very few people you can start to get to. Like I got to interview George S. Irving or like, you know, people like that who will talk about the 40s. There's like a very small amount of them. Mm. And then you get to the 50s and it's like maybe a little easier, but there's still not a lot of people still around. So it's like, it every year that goes by, like there are people I was dying to interview who've left us since I started the series. And it's just, if you don't capture the stories, they're gone.
Well, I think that's, we can definitely relate to you on that because that was part of the reason why we started this podcast with interviewing, because we wanted to capture those stories before they are gone.
That's amazing.
Do you plan to ever release the audio interviews?
Do you know what? The tricky thing is that because the book is actually so edited in a way that like the first book we released, we did an audio book and we were like, wouldn't it be cool to use parts of the recorded interviews? They're not fancy recorded the way you guys are doing, you know, your fancy podcast. Some of them are much worse quality or much better quality, which actually in doing like interviews, it's like sometimes when I'm in a dressing room with someone, it's the right situation to be interviewing them and I'm like, this audio is going to be terrible, but like it's good that we're in your dressing room because that's a setting for it, whatever. But the interviews are actually so different than what is in the book. They really are. It's really a lot of like, I this is a weird way to say it, but I like fact check people's memories, and most of the time it's, you know, someone will be like, oh, I did this in, you know, 1968 and then I did this, and I'm like, no, you did this first and then that in 1969 or whatever it is. So there's a lot of that, and then there's a lot of because it's theater by theater, I might talk to someone for an hour and I might talk to them about the St. James in minute 10, in minute 14, and in minute 50.
Right.
And so then you're knitting those three like memories together for a St. James story. So the audio recording is at some point, I, you know, might surface in some way, but they're not the book. Like the book is very edited.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
How did you decide on the first theaters that you were going to put in the first book, the first batch?
It's such a puzzle, and it's such a cool puzzle to me. But like, I really did, the first eight theaters that I did were the ones I had been able to get the most information about and the most like well-rounded stories. A lot of what figuring out who to interview is going like, oh, I need a stagehand from the Lyric and I need someone who worked at the St. James in the 50s and I need a woman's perspective on this, or like a person of color's perspective on this show, or trying to be inclusive of people of different ages and races and genders and jobs and just like so many different things. And so someone might have worked, like someone who I really want to interview who's really awesome might have only worked at these four theaters, and three of them I've already done, and so like I shouldn't interview them. So it's a weird like puzzle of that.
I didn't know it was that specific, that you were looking to cover all of those different things.
And it's not easy because like one of the theaters that's in this third book has been a really big challenge to find people on house staff to talk to, and this is the only time that this ever has happened to me in like almost 300 interviews. But I interviewed someone, I finally got like house staff member from the theater to do an interview, and it was lovely. It was a great interview. We had a wonderful time, and this person like had read the book and was a fan of the book, and then a couple days later was like, you know what, I don't feel comfortable going on the record about my job. And there was nothing negative about the interview, like it wasn't, nothing bad was about it, but they were like, I don't feel like my job is to be in the public eye. And this has been, it's been a recurring theme with people who, because I interview a lot of people that are never interviewed, like just people
like a house manager
totally. And I said, you
I
know,
love that. You I totally, that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I said, I totally understand. Is there anything I could do to make you more comfortable? Do you want to like see some quotes? Like I didn't, there's nothing that maybe you're alarmed by something and we can cut it out or, and this person was just like, no, I just don't feel comfortable. And then I was like, oh my God, I'm back to square one. I'm not having this perspective at all from this theater, which is okay, but it's, you know, I don't, for me, like I don't want the books to not represent anything fully, and so it's a challenge to kind of make sure that I do everything I can. Yep. Like I can't, if I can't find someone from the 40s from the Broadhurst, then like what are you gonna do? But like you try your best.
How do you find house staff and people? I mean, really, it's not like you can go on internet. And I mean, how do you find people from the 50s and 40s and 60s?
It's
even
been so, oh my God,
because they're not
challenge.
On IBDB, you know? Like.
Yeah, it's a lot of it is going, oh, this person I know is around and worked at the Broadhurst in the 40s per se, and I don't know them, but I know this person, and they would know that person. I can ask them to connect me. So that's been a part of it. But another part of it has been like leaving letters at stage doors, like friends who, you know, I'll say, oh, I have these friends who worked at the Schoenfeld. Maybe I can ask them what stage door men they know at the Schoenfeld or women or whoever. So I've done a lot of like, you know, thinking about which friends have worked at which theaters and might know house staff. It's just like a lot of that.
Wild.
It's like spelunking.
It's like real detective work.
It really is. It's spelunking. It's spelunking. But it's been really exciting because like I'm writing about these theaters and I'm like, you know, I'm like, oh, I have 2 hours today. I'm going to really dive into the 1910s at the Schoenfeld. And then it's like, I have friends that are in the Schoenfeld right now. So it really like, my whole goal of this is like to make history tangible for people and to make it so that someone who loves Wicked is like, I want to read about the Gershwin where Wicked is, and then goes like, oh cool, Sweeney Todd and like Via Galactica and what else has been here. And so, you know, being able to be like, I'm writing about the 1910s of the Schoenfeld. Oh my God, I have to tell my friend that like this crazy thing happened in 1917, like whatever, because he's in that box right now. It's like these physical spaces connect all of us.
And still have
so
been, are
years.
You being used in the exact same way that they were used 100 years ago? I mean, that's pretty magical.
One of like my favorite parts of the third book that I'm like so excited about is that the Schoenfeld and the Broadhurst are like connected through these secret tunnels.
When I did Les Mis, I have to, I mean, to give up.
No, but, no, go ahead.
Because this is one of those things that not a lot of people know, but there is a door between those two theaters. And so Chorus Line was going on in that theater, and we were in the Broadhurst, and we would, during One Day More, the whole cast of A Chorus Line would be like in our wing watching us sing, and then we'd go watch them do one and there. Because but it was like a little pass door. I mean, it was like this little secret door, and there's like a little alley, and you can go in. And it's wild that like no one would know that you could like hang out backstage and watch someone else's show.
I love that. Celia told me like that when she would die as Eponine, she would go watch Chorus Line, like which so I love. I didn't know that everybody did, and I love knowing that. But what's really cool is like it's obviously like very unique. It's not, no other two theaters have that exact, like there's literally a pass door to get from the Broadhurst Schoenfeld. And so like throughout history, like probably like I have stories from like the 70s of this going on. So it's like, and then it's like the story, it's another thing that makes
it. We weren't
it
the first ones to do it. We thought we were. We thought we were so smart.
And it's so funny. I love when it's too, because it's also like Jekyll and Hyde and Fosse would watch each other the same way that you guys did with Chorus Line. And so like it's so funny. And then like Jeremy Jordan told me that Hugh Jackman would just come say hi to them at Bonnie and Clyde. Like there's this pastor has like this, you know, history. So it's stuff like that that's really unique to Broadway that makes it a community in ways people don't expect. I'm really excited to give like the 50 years of this Schoenfeld Broadhurst pastor.
That's awesome. That's so crazy. Because no one tells you either. You just kind of discover it on your own. It's wild.
Totally. And it's really like what I saw it for the first time. I have my friend Charlie Rosen who's working on American Psycho. And I was like, let's go see the pastor. And so we did. And we literally were like, oh, we're on the Tuck Everlasting set. Yeah. Like you open the door and you're like, because there's a few different ways to go back and forth, but they're really, and it's.
And you're right on stage. I mean, it's like right, and the wing space is not big. So you're like,
And they all, I've uncovered a couple different things. Like I've heard that, you know, obviously the Schuberts have all those theaters very interconnected so that they could travel back and forth without being like noticed or seen. And so, you know, the way that like the Schubert and the booth and like all those theaters you can get back and forth through like tunnels and fire escapes and things. That was part of it. But then also it was like, because like a lot of the theaters, the Schoenfeld and Broadhurst are actually like sister theaters. They were built at the same time. I've heard that like, so they would only have to have one heating plant. They had to be connected in that way. Like different things like that, that have literally affected like friendships and hundreds of years of history. Yeah. It's just so funny to like intricacies of Broadway.
Do you still get awestruck when you walk through a theater door?
Totally. Totally. I was thinking about this recently. Like, I haven't been backstage at every theater, and it's because I, like, want to save some. It's like, I don't want to, like, the same way it's like I like going theater by theater in these books, and, like, the Schoenfeld is really special to me right now, and I'm spending so much time on it in a way that if I was just writing one book about all 40 theaters, it would just be, you know, all 40 theaters. Like, it's each theater becomes special to you in its own way, and, like, I hope to have memories that are, like, backstage in the theater of all of them, of course, but it's like I don't want it all to be, like, over in some weird way.
Totally.
So I've saved some.
Now, do you plan on including theaters that have been demolished or no longer with us anymore?
Yeah, I guess. So it was a big part of what I wanted to do is the first book has the Mark Hellinger, which we know is the Times Square Church now. And that was, you know, a Broadway theater for so many years up until the late 80s. And so that was really great to get stories about because also I have, you know, I think we all have this hope for it that at some point it actually could turn back into a Broadway theater.
And you can go in and it's still preserved.
Yeah.
I mean, you can still see the beautiful, I mean, like it's a gorgeous theater that's still, I mean, it's not been churchified.
Totally. Well, the church has like, totally, they've kept it up. It's like if the right money and transaction came into place, like the theater's not destroyed. It's like very amazing. It's very beautiful. It looks just like when My Fair Lady was there or when Rags was there. And so I wrote about that in the first book. And in the second book, I included the Criterion Center stage right, which was a roundabout house, which was gotten rid of, but was a roundabout space in the 90s mostly. And then the third book actually includes the Edison. And the Edison has been awesome to talk about because I've hunted down some people, and God bless Maria Didia, who is a general manager and amazing producer. Like, she's a woman of many hats, who was very integral in the Edison history. But like the Edison, as you know, is the Hotel Edison's ballroom event space. But that was a Broadway theater for 1 year in 1950, and then from like 1970 to 1990. And it was like, it could be in the round. Like, they did stuff in the round. Oh, Calcutta was there for a long time.
Wow.
And it has this crazy history. Like, it is, it actually has like an, it, I don't
no
even
idea.
Know where to start. And that's in the third book.
I had no
book.
Idea. I
yeah.
just, wow.
Yeah.
So it's still there. It's just, you
it's
can.
It's still there. It was built as the hotel's ballroom. And in 1950, this theater company went, wow, theater in the round is becoming a thing all over America. Why don't we have a theater in the round on Broadway? They kind of purchased, they rented the Edison and they did some theater in the round. They did like basically a not-for-profit structure for about a year. And it, you know, was a success in some ways and not in others, but they just didn't have the money to continue. So it was literally like a Broadway theater for 1 year. And this was pre-Circle in the Square. So it was like, there wasn't any other theater in the round. And then in 1970, Norman Keene, who's this producer, kind of turned the Edison back into a Broadway theater. And for 20 years, he and Maria Didia, who started out as a dancer and was then an usher, was then a temp, was then his assistant, and then went on to like manage the theater, basically. She's the coolest lady. She kind of, each chapter, I like to think, has kind of a narrator. And usually it's someone who like really spent some time at that theater. And she's been such a helpful narrator about the Edison. But the Edison, for 20 years, was this, it wasn't owned by the Schuberts, Nederlander, or Judjamsen. It was this independent theater where like they had a bar before any other theater had a bar because there were no rules. They could have a bar. They just had to get a license and that was it. So like other theaters would be like, hey, this bar seems to work. Maybe we should have more alcohol in our theater. Like,
and charge
Edison,
$20.
Totally. But the Edison was like, it was just more scrappy than anything that we've that we have in our time.
Yeah.
And the Edison went, oh, like we have 500 seats. How amazing to have a Broadway theater with 500 seats. We can take shows that are playing somewhere else, like a Broadway theater that is 800 or 1,000 seats that are really good shows, but are kind of like, you know, winding down. And just like what New World Stages does now, we can bring them to us and have them continue. So they did a lot of that.
Wow.
But can you imagine the like musicals we could do if we had a 500 seat that made sense Broadway theater? Like, I'm fascinated by the Edison. It's a lot in the book. And also, like, they did the original Love Letters there, so I have some interviews about that. A lot of, you know, people auditioned on that. Or actually, another interesting is the BMI showcase was on that stage for many years.
Ooh.
So the first time that, like, Maury Yeston heard Nine on a Broadway stage was at the Edison, or Michael John Lacusa heard his work on Broadway. It has this, I mean, the Edison is going to be I did not know this. This is all news to me.
Yeah, so cool. Really fascinating.
And it's still, I mean, you can walk in, you can go to like a benefit there because it's an event space, but someday it could also be a Broadway theater again. It's kind of a dream that
fingers crossed.
Right.
Fingers crossed.
The Edison
on that
and the Hellinger.
Jeez. Now, you have such a large social media following. Do you feel any responsibility to the next generation of artists that are coming up?
Wow.
Totally. It's a really good question. I mean, I really think that, like, social media, of course, we all know has pros and cons, but the pros of it really outweigh the cons for me. And when I think about the fact that, like, we can do something cool at 54 Below that celebrates, like, a musical, and then not only can the 147 people in that room see it, it can go on YouTube and it can go on Twitter, and, like, you can do a podcast where you're talking about these things that someone who, like, can't come in person because they don't live in New York can't come, like, see it live, but, like, by doing it as a podcast and putting on social media, you can like reach people. And like, mm-hmm. I just like, I spend enough time talking to people who are high school students or college students who are not in New York to know just what that means and how it gives access to people that, you know, wouldn't have had access. And so I just feel like social media, like I love being like, I'm obsessed with the Schoenfeld and I'm reading about and writing about the Schoenfeld today. Like everybody, let's talk about the Schoenfeld. Yes. And then you kind of can't, like literally I did this last night. I like can't get off of the Schoenfeld, but it's, I think social media is so cool in that way. And I do feel responsibility to like younger people to kind of use it responsibly, but by which I just mean like, you know, I don't find anything interesting or fun in being like, I hated this show, nobody go see it. Like, what is interesting or fun about that? Like, if I don't like something I see, like, let's go have a beer and we're friends and let's go like talk about what we thought about it. But like announcing to a bunch of strangers on the internet about it, I don't find productive or helpful for anyone. Like,
yep, right.
I'm not a critic. Like, it's just not even interesting to me. And I think that some people do, for some reason, find it like whatever to that. Like, they want to share that on social media. Yeah. I don't even have that instinct. But I do think that part of being responsible is just noting over and over, like, I might have not liked X musical. It might not be something that I'm posting about a lot, but like, you should go see it if it's interesting to you. Maybe you will love it. Like, everyone's gonna have different opinions. The most responsible thing I can do is be like, go make your own decisions about right. all these shows.
But see theater.
Right, exactly.
But get
like,
there.
One person's follies is another person's sweetie tot. Like, whatever. Like, I don't know what people's opinions
so
are going to be different.
It's art.
It's art, totally. So I just try to emphasize that.
But that's wonderful. And that's something we respect so much about you, which is everything is so positive. There's nothing pejorative. There's nothing negative. And it would be so easy yeah. to do that. And I think that trickles down to everybody else. And I think that's wonderful.
Yeah. Thanks.
What is the best piece of advice you've gotten, even more specifically, and from who was it?
Yeah, you know, I think about this a lot because the title of Show Gang were very formative to me, and they really taught me a lot about what it meant to be like a professional in this industry. And really, like, it's a similar thing to what we were just talking about, but it's really like, don't fit the mold. Like, even if you're an actor, like, you're unique in 100 ways, and like, what, you might be an actor and you might also be interested in photography, or you might be an actor who can play this role and that role that don't seem to match. And it's just like, there's no mold. And like, a lot of what this business is going like, oh, I'm replacing the sixth person on tour in Mamma Mia, I have to fit that mold. And you do for that one particular moment that you're in that job, but it's also like really like kind of treasuring and celebrating the ways that you're unique and, you know, embracing that in other people too.
And now, before we talk about your amazing job at Feinstein's 54 Below, you are also probably one of the biggest advocates of new musical
uh-huh.
theater.
Yes.
It's not just the past.
History.
It's really looking to
the
future as well. How did you get involved in the advocacy of new musicals?
I mean, I think that like we're in such an exciting time, and I've always been excited by what's happening now as much as like history. I think there are so many great people writing now. Obviously, there's so many great people performing and directing, and like we're just living in this age where, I mean, there's like a lot of good stuff happening, especially in the center of it in New York. I first got involved in new musicals. My first internship that I ever did was at the York Theater, love the York. And they do obviously a lot of older stuff, bring back to life. They also do new musicals. And I also, like, in college, I interned at the Rodgers and Hammerstein Organization because I love TED so much. And they license a lot of older musicals and a lot of newer musicals. So it's like all these ways that it's all tied together. And I work a lot with Joe Iconis, who's a musical theater writer and a frequent collaborator of mine, on a lot of his stuff. And so that's kind of given me like a real window into what a current new musical theater writer is working on and going through, and the challenges and the successes of it and all everything else. And so this new musical series that I kind of spearheaded and produced the series of at Feinstein's 54 Below, we did these 10 new musicals over the course of a couple months that were all like concert presentations of shows that have not been produced in New York yet, but have been produced in out of town or a significant amount of workshops, and really getting them on stage with full bands and with really exciting casts and getting videos and getting important people there and getting just like excited family and friends and fans there. And they've been these really wonderful experiences that, you know, the idea wasn't like all 10 of these shows are going to go to Broadway now, but they've really gotten some good opportunities for all the writers and people involved as far as new people hearing their work.
Now tell us, how did your job at 54 Below come about?
What's weird about that is I also like truly every job I've ever gotten has been because I was like, I'm gonna do a thing I like, and then like God bless some spirit in the universe, like someone's hired me to do it. So I was hired to be the programming director because Joe Iconis and I work with each other a lot, and I had produced some of his concerts at 54 Below, you know, obviously, you know, freelance in my free time, like while I was at another job. And when they were looking for a programming director, everyone over at the club was kind of like, oh, get that girl who did those shows. We liked her. Like, she was organized and whatever else. And so I got asked to come in and talk about the job because I had been doing stuff that was just like things I cared about with Joe at the club. So
are we living in a new golden age of musical theater?
I really think we are. I mean, I was thinking about this. I try to, like, you know, we all read these numbers and statistics that are being put out, but it's like there are at least 11 new musicals that are announced for next season on Broadway, like already in, you know, June. And so, I mean, if you look at how, like, look at 5 years ago, there were definitely not that many. Like, there are just the volume of new shows, I think, points to a new golden age. A lot of things do, but the volume of new shows definitely one aspect.
If nothing else, at least the mass number of things that are coming in.
There's a lot.
Because the ticket prices aren't going down, you know?
Yeah, no. I mean, a lot of it really has to do, I think, with, like, mainstream media. And, like, movies and TV and regular music have made musicals seem... Like, look at it. It's this season. It's, like, Sarah Bareilles making musicals seem cool and Steve Martin making musicals seem cool. And it's, like, welcome those people. Like, you're welcome here, too. And also, thank you for, like, bringing that out into the world.
Yeah.
And Sting recently.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, there's part of that. And then it's also, like, the energizing of the Disney movie musical that makes people go, oh, my kids love Frozen, let's go take them to see Mary Poppins. Like, whatever it is, that's not correct because Mary Poppins closed before Frozen. But, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, the chronology, see, I just fact-checked myself.
Now we don't have to edit that out. Great.
Yeah, it's fine. I think it's a lot of that. And I have done some interviews that have been really interesting about how a lot of the new golden age has to do with the material and the amount of work that's so wonderful, having to do with the fact that we lost an entire generation to AIDS, and then it took this long for, because we forget, like, you know, of course we lost people that we all know. We lost the Michael Bennetts, we lost the Peter Allens, but we also lost these people that were just coming up that hadn't had a chance to make their mark yet, that it took this long for the community and the industry to really recover from that in a way. And it took this long for people to grow up with all of the popular types of music that, you know, like the way that Lin-Manuel, like, has grown up loving musical theater as much as he loved all these forms that now he's integrating into it. And it's all these things that just took time to evolve and, you know, come to the forefront and make musical theater have as many people that are creating top-notch stuff as there are now. There's just so many factors to it.
I'm excited to see the next generation, like, that loves Lin-Manuel, like, what that's going to be, because the craft is all still there. And so it's I think you're right. It's going to be an exciting time ahead of us.
Totally. I just hope it's like, it's not that everyone should go write rap musicals or like R&B musicals. It's that everyone should be coming up with these authentic ways to tell new stories and ways. And
that's
like, you just hope we're not going to get, and maybe if
we will. Oh, we will.
But that's the thing. If you look at these, like, throughout history, it's like anytime there's a huge hit, there's like five shows that come in the 5 years after that copy it in some way that is unhelpful. And it's like with jukebox musicals that kind of happened, or like with shows that copied Hair, or, you know, there's a lot of
even Oklahoma
that.
At so the time, like, there were like, you know, they would do, there were a couple shows that were flops after
100%,
Oklahoma.
100%.
That were trying to emulate that idea.
So I think it's so awesome that like a lot of stuff doesn't seem like it's copying it in that way right now, but I'm sure we're going to get at least one like James, you know, Monroe rap musical. Like, I just feel like
an all Asian cast. It's going to be fantastic.
And it purposelessly. Yes. Something like that will happen and it will be fine, and then we'll remember it for the good things about it. And
that will be able to get tickets too.
Exactly.
It's so, I can't believe, like, I think you just have to find out when when tickets go on sale for the next block and buy them for like a year from now.
That's, yeah, I should just do that.
That's the way to do it.
I should do that. Man. Maybe I'll just sneak in. Isn't that horrible?
Just put on my revolutionary I'm sure there's like
costume and walk through the stage door.
That it could happen.
Here for the show.
Yeah. There are some I loved. Oh my God, Lin-Manuel tweeted someone from Shuffle Along practicing Tap in the Alley the other day because the Music Box and the Imperial also share like that weird alley.
Yeah.
And the Rogers Music Box Imperial. It's like, you know, interconnected theaters.
Now let me ask you really quickly about Shuffle Along because I know you're.
It's like my favorite thing ever.
Does it belong as a best new musical category?
Oh, definitely. Well, what's fascinating about it to me, and which I don't know why everyone isn't talking about this more, it's like it's definitely a new musical. It is not Shuffle Along from 1921 being revived. But in 1921, when they did Shuffle Along, musicals were so different that when they revived, and I'm putting that in air quotes, Shuffle Along, you know, 20 years later and 30 years later on Broadway, it was as much what Shuffle Along was as this one is. Like, what a revival used to be was like, hey, we'll take some of those same characters and some of those same songs and do some tap dances because they like the tap dances in the original. And it was not as much, like, it wasn't a revival the way we know what a revival is. So when Shuffle Along was revived in the 50s, it was as much Shuffle Along as this is. So I just thought that was a really interesting argument for being like, why it's a revival versus an original. Weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
So weird. And then also it's like the way that things in that production are emulating what the production, like the fact that Savion Glover's going in as like a specialty act, like there's no role, he's not going into a role, they're putting him in as Savion Glover. It's like they are emulating the spirit and like the form of the 1920s in a way that I just have never seen a Broadway show do that ever.
Because for our listeners, like Broadway shows weren't always just like the story starts and then the story ended, but back in the 20s and earlier, I mean, it would be, you would have specialty acts, you'd have a loose storyline if you had a storyline at all, then you'd have a star come in and they'd sing their signature song numbers, and then so it was a slightly different setup than what we're used to today, and it's nice to have a little capsule of history, I think, on stage so that we get to know what that world was like.
That's a good explanation of it. It's I'm so obsessed with that show. I just think that like it's so moving to me to see these people that really made history and changed what our art form was and that people don't remember being remembered. Like, it's so powerful to see, like, these people really did change. Like, there was a number that got cut that I was kind of devastated that got cut. Actually, it's so weird. So when people ask me, like, if you had a time machine, what would you go back and see? And I'm always like, probably Follies. And now I'm like, I didn't see the first 2 weeks of previews of Shuffle Along or the making of dot, dot, dot. And I would go back to March of this year because I can't believe I did not go to the first 2 weeks. There's like 45 minutes of one of my favorite shows I've ever seen that I never saw because I like didn't go until the third week. What's wrong with me? But so there was this number that got cut in between literally like the people who saw it at the beginning also, I will say I'm jealous of them, but like they should go see it again because it's a different show. When I saw it the second time versus the third time, there was a number that was cut that was all of these people going uptown to see Shuffle Along, and the whole ensemble had these masks, and one of their front of their mask was one person, the back was another person, and it was just like a who's who of all of these important people in American literature and music and everything, society, that were going to see the show. And you get a little bit of that that's still there of like how George Gershwin took part of the, you know, melody that a musician was playing and turned it into a song, and the way people reappropriated this art that was not properly archived or remembered, so they didn't get the proper credit. But that number that was cut, you know, and I'm sure there were 100 reasons to cut it, and I think George C. Wolfe was a genius and we're not criticizing, but it was like, that was so crazy to me to see all these names that people knew who they were, and they have no idea who these main characters are who we're seeing all night, but they knew who these people with the masks were. All those people went to see this, and then they did stuff I do know about because of it. Like,
oh, they were inspired.
That's interesting. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. If that didn't exist, then they would not have ever done any of that.
I wonder where they went away.
I think that they make the point in other ways, and you do get to see the way that, and the big story is how George Gershwin took a couple notes from Shuffle Along and turned it into a very famous song.
Yeah.
So you do get parts of it, but I just thought the power of having the whole ensemble be like, and this person, and that person, and flipping the masks, and doing the dance, and it just, that really, that was one part that I was sad got cut.
And also something really unique is that most shows now don't really preview like this, where there's so many changes going in during the preview period.
They shut down for a week. They shut down for, because it was, you know, they were it's like it couldn't go out of town. It was too crazy and expensive and big. And they literally, they were doing a different show at the beginning than they were doing at the end of previews, like Merrily, only like they had enough power and clout, and the way that they did it, they had enough knowledge to do it in a way that hopefully didn't hurt them as much. And I don't think it did.
And in this day and age, you know, we don't get to see that happen very often with a new show.
No.
It's very rare.
Someone's tweeting about it and telling you,
Well, that's the other thing. Like, I feel like with the internet, is it any different to be in Boston doing what they were doing than it is to be on 45th Street? Maybe a little bit, but like with the internet, kind of not.
No.
Like, anyone can tweet from Boston, like, whatever.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a new world, Golda. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's a little Fiddler on the Roof
that's
for
nice,
you.
That's nice, Rob.
There's so many good revivals this
Oh, yeah,
season.
The good revival. Jeez.
Yeah.
I just want to say that.
Well, I'm seeing She Loves Me Tonight. I'm seeing Color Purple tomorrow, so Ooh. Finally catching up.
They're so good. There's so much good stuff. I mean, there's so many good revivals. I love the Fiddler revival. Mm.
Fiddler was great. Spring Awakening was beautiful. It's just a damn good season. That's exactly what we kept saying during the Tony Awards.
I love that you guys are both catching up in such extreme ways. Like, you're both seeing so many shows now.
It's like a marathon.
Yeah, it's good, though.
We saw American Psycho, Neverland. Yeah, all the good ones.
I saw Tuck Everlasting a couple days ago before it closed. I knew I needed to see something that's going to close so quickly. And
I'm really sad for them.
Me too.
There was so much that was really beautiful about that show.
Agreed.
The ballet at the end. I was just like,
and I'm excited for those guys to see more of their work.
Oh, yeah.
Songwriting was quite good.
They'll be back.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they'll be back, and hopefully you'll be back with us again.
You guys, thank you for having me.
Oh, what a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
That's a delight.
Thank you. And of course, for all of our listeners, we'll post links to where you can purchase the books.
Get that book.
Yeah, and we can't
so
wait
good.
To see what's next.
I'm so excited to share that third book with you guys. I've talked so much about the Edison and Schoenfeld. You must be like, what are you talking
had
about?
No idea about
minds
this.
Are blown. Minds are blown. Yeah. What do you think, November?
November.
Great.
Yep.
Just wonderful. Time for Christmas and Hanukkah, everybody.
Yep.
Get the new Jen Tepper book. All right. Take care, everybody.
Bye, everybody. Bye.
Join us next week when we interview legendary Broadway gypsy Lawrence Merritt.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.